advocates to people like Pope Francis, and it really bubbled up more after he pardoned his own son, Hunter Biden, who was convicted of tax and gun charges. Mm-hmm. And after that happened, Biden used his clemency powers to pardon 39 people who had been convicted of nonviolent crimes. He commuted the sentences of about 1,500 people who had been on home confinement during the COVID-19 pandemic. But advocates considered those actions to be pretty small overall, and they were really waiting on Biden and calling on him to take this big step on the death penalty here. And I will say the reaction to this new announcement has been pretty positive so far. Advocates like Brian Stevenson, who is known for his advocacy for fighting for innocent folks on death row, praised Biden for his decision. And he said it sends a message that the death penalty isn't the answer to concerns about public safety.
Just briefly here, how much of Biden's decision was also impacted by how the incoming Trump administration might handle federal executions?
Yeah, I mean, Biden took pretty sweeping action here on the death penalty compared to previous Democratic presidents. And he did kind of hint at the incoming Trump administration for why he made this decision. Mm-hmm. Back in 2021, Biden put a moratorium on federal executions, but that could have been undone by Trump. And mm-hmm. Biden said he didn't want to stand back and let a new administration resume executions that he halted.
That's NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
If someone sends you a postcard from Lebanon, it may show ancient ruins against a turquoise Mediterranean backdrop. Lebanon is a relatively small country, chock full of antiquities. Think Crusader castles, Ottoman architecture. This fall, though, it was a war zone between Israel and Hezbollah. Now, with a ceasefire in place, Lebanon has begun assessing damage to the historical sites it holds dear. NPR's Lauren Freyer visited several of them.
Tell me where we are now. This looks like Rome.
Yes, this is the leftovers of the Roman Empire. We have a huge basilica with the Roman columns.
Archaeologist Mahmoud Ghazal shows me beautifully preserved Roman ruins stretching down to the Mediterranean. You can almost see the chariots racing. This is a UNESCO World Heritage Site in the city of Tyre on Lebanon's south coast. The roof of the adjacent ticket office is painted with a massive blue and white shield.
So it can be seen by warplanes.
Warplanes, yes, to be protected.
Marking it as protected cultural property under a UN treaty which Israel and Lebanon have both signed. But a couple of hundred yards away, crews are shoveling rubble. In addition to more than 4,000 people killed this fall in Lebanon by attacks Israel says are aimed at Hezbollah, huge swaths of this country have been leveled, including the city surrounding these ruins, where Hezbollah enjoys lots of support.
It was destroyed, the third sector of the city of Tyre.
So this was a walled old city, and these are the fortifications?
A Byzantine-era wall was destroyed. Ottoman-era homes collapsed. Some museum artifacts got bubble-wrapped and whisked north by the Lebanese army. But you can't bubble-wrap whole buildings.
So this lady's showing us a ceiling that's kind of fallen down here.
And like other UNESCO World Heritage sites that have also seen recent fighting, the Greco-Roman temples of Baalbek in eastern Lebanon, the Neolithic, Roman, and Persian ruins of Palmyra in nearby Syria, archaeologists have yet to x-ray these ancient columns for hairline fractures. Elsewhere, though, the damage to antiquities is obvious with the naked eye and overwhelming.
There's stone arches and crystal chandeliers and paintings of Christian saints on the walls, some stained glass, and it's like one wall of the church is sheared off, and there's twisted rebar and part of the roof sort of dangling off.
Israel accuses Hezbollah of hiding weapons and fighters in places like these. It often gives evacuation warnings before it attacks. But Lebanese officials say 8 people were killed in an October airstrike on this 19th century Greek Catholic church in the village of Derd Raya. The Israeli military confirmed the airstrike, but said it was targeting what it calls terrorists who unlawfully embed near or underneath cultural heritage sites. In another village down the road, the white marble minaret of a 250-year-old mosque lies on its side in the street.
There are some Qurans here.
Here's a Quran, Kareem.
Two elderly locals, Ali Sharaf Eddin and Najib Yassin, show me around the damage and urge me to Google it. This is a famous old building, they say, and nobody has come to log the damage. Not the United Nations, not the government, not anyone, they say. From afar, the World Bank estimates Lebanon's losses at $8.5 billion.
When you keep monuments standing, then you can actually keep the history alive.
Joanne Farshuk Bojali is a specialist in heritage architecture, who, since a ceasefire in late November, has been making her way around to all of the properties on Lebanon's National Register of Historic Places to see if they're still there.
I want you to see the facade, and then I want you to walk with me to the other side.
Okay.
I met up with her in Nabatiya, regional capital of the country's south, where a 13th century Mamluk-era market was destroyed, along with hundreds of buildings. She walks me around one of them, a late Lebanese Ottoman-style house that was damaged in the last war with Israel in 2006, rebuilt into a cultural center, and now destroyed again.
Well, this is the remains. There's nothing.
There's nothing.
Yeah. This is totally destroyed.
There's a burned car upside down. There's some children's playthings. There's a children's fun house.
There had been a playground outside. Bojali has brought a photographer, Kamal Jaber, who spent his life documenting Lebanon's old houses. For many of these properties, he's got the before pictures and is now taking the after ones. He says there were no Hezbollah fighters in these heritage homes. And moreover, he believes that with these attacks, Israel was not after Hezbollah, but instead Lebanon's antiquities, its history, and thus its claim to this land. These are the places where the scent of our ancestors still lingers, he says. As in Gaza, Israel denies that its intention has been to lay waste to huge swaths of this country, only that it's responding to militant attacks that come from these same areas.
There's been a fortress here since 850 BC.
The walls of Tibnin Castle, near the border with Israel, tell Lebanon's story. The foundations are Aramaic and Assyrian. The turrets were built by the Crusaders. Ali Fawaz is a municipal official in charge of this castle. He was heartened when, in mid-November, when this region was under heavy Israeli bombardment, the United Nations added his beloved hometown castle and 33 other sites to its protection list, hoping to mitigate damage to them. But today, the roof of this castle is strewn with chunks of debris thrown here by the force of explosions. And one of its Crusader-era walls has crumbled. Fawaz is heartbroken.
Very sad. That's a very important place. It's our history. So you feel from inside something who cut it from you. They come here to enjoy every summer. So, you know... That's so bad.
As we stand on the roof of this castle, looking across snow-capped mountains to Syria in the east and Israel due south, Israeli drones buzz past us, and we hear the booms of artillery in the distance.
Yeah, should we go?
There is a ceasefire in Lebanon, but there is also still some fighting. Thousands of people are still unable to return home, and there are many antiquities they also have not been able to reach either. Lauren Freyer, NPR News at Tibnin Castle in southern Lebanon.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. Support comes from Educators Credit Union. Does your financial institution pay you? At Educators Credit Union, members earn record amounts of cash back with member loyalty. In 2024 will be no different. You're invited to start building your reward today at ecu.com.
Christmas songs. It's part two of the session we recorded with him. And we'll listen back to Amir Questlove Thompson playing recordings from the Christmas playlist he put together for us. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Google. This year, Google is announcing the breakout searches of 2024 that captured the world's attention and shaped our year in ways we never saw coming. Learn more at g.co/yearinsearch. Google, search on. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. The origin story of Bob Dylan gets the big screen treatment with the release this week of A Complete Unknown, the new movie starring Timothée Chalamet.
200 people in that room, and each one wants me to be somebody else. And they should just let me be.
Let you be what?
Whatever it is they don't want me to be.
In recent years, we have seen a flurry of music biopics. Not all of them great, according to Stephen Thompson of NPR Music. He caught an early screening of this new Dylan film, and he is here to talk about it with us. Hey there.
Hey, Asma.
So, what'd you think?
Well, I think it's effectively made, and I think it avoids a lot of the worst flaws in the biopic structure. The main thing it gets right, I think the performances are largely really effective. We'll get to Timothée Chalamet in a second, but I like his work here quite a bit. There are some great supporting performances, particularly from Edward Norton as Pete Seeger and Rebecca Barbaro as Joan Baez. I think those performances and those real-life people who represent different kinds of idealism, I think they're really important to undercutting the things about Bob Dylan as a person that are less than ideal. It's not a perfect movie. There are cliches, lots of lingering shots of wet-eyed women watching him perform, that sort of thing. But it's very smart to focus on a small sliver of Dylan's career instead of trying for one of these cradle-to-grave filmed Wikipedia entries that we sometimes get in this genre.
Okay, so you said Timothée Chalamet's performance was quite effective, because sometimes in these biopics, an actor can come across like he or she is doing an impression of a famous person rather than becoming the character.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring this up. I think what works about this performance is that he's not doing a note-for-note, tick-for-tick Dylan impersonation, which I appreciate. He's more going for the general vibe. There's a sullenness to the performance. You see the selfishness of a young genius who thinks he's got the world on his shoulders. Mm. You can understand why people are drawn to him. You can understand how he drives people away. And I think, in a way, it's kind of a full-circle performance for Timothée Chalamet. If you think about the character he played in Lady Bird back in 2017, one of his breakthrough performances, he's playing this kind of self-absorbed, unformed twerp. And I think he's using a lot of that energy here while still kind of conveying what's electrifying about this guy and his talent.
Hmm. Okay, so I am very curious here. Was he actually singing? Do you hear his voice here?
Yes. And okay. In fact, the soundtrack, you know, is full of all these Dylan songs, and they are performed by Timothée Chalamet.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline.
The four main actors who are playing singers here, Timothée Chalamet, Rebecca Barbaro as Joan Baez, Edward Norton as Pete Seeger, and Boyd Holbrook as Johnny Cash, they're all doing all their own singing here. And I think, you know, they're not perfect imitations, but they're capturing the vibe.
I've got to imagine, as an actor, as an actress, this feels like a really impossible task. I mean, I recently saw, it came out a couple of years ago, but I recently saw it, the movie about Aretha Franklin that starred Jennifer Hudson.
Oh, yeah.
Like, how does someone become Aretha Franklin. How does someone become that voice, that person? It feels like as a genre, these are just really hard things to pull off.
Yeah, and I think that respect, that Aretha Franklin movie, mm-hmm. it really kind of falls into the category of the filmed Wikipedia entry. That's the kind of movie for me when I think about biopics and what doesn't work about them. That's the kind of movie I think about, where you like have a great actor at the center. You have a great singer at the center. Jennifer Hudson's a fantastic
Amazing.
Singer.
Yeah.
But she's not going to sound like Aretha. Nobody sounds like Aretha Franklin, and that's kind of the point, and that's one of the central challenges of some of these films.
What makes one work? What doesn't make one work? I mean, what is missing when you get a dud?
Well, I think there are so many ways to mess up this genre. You get the VH1 Behind the Music problem, where there's such a familiar arc. Everybody knows that arc by now. Sometimes you get the cinematic equivalent of like a jukebox musical, where you've got these recreations of songs and impersonations, but there's not much else to say beyond that, which I don't think is an issue with The Complete Unknown. And sometimes the only thing worse than an unauthorized biography is an authorized biography. Sometimes these movies get really tainted by the agendas of the people who've signed off on having their story told. This is one of the things that for me completely ruined Bohemian Rhapsody, the Queen movie. You just have the fingerprints of the surviving members of Queen all over that movie.
Okay. So what makes a really great biopic? Who got it right?
Well, I think some are just made in interesting ways. I mean, Baz Luhrmann's Elvis is kind of a mess, but it's so great looking and stylishly made.
He does that with so many of his films, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of couldn't help but be fun to watch, even though it's deeply flawed. Some use kind of unusual, even experimental techniques to break out of these formulas. There's another movie about Bob Dylan called I'm Not There that is taking a much more experimental approach to him. There are six different actors portray him. A movie like 32 Short Films about Glenn Gould, where the kind of the structure of the film is really inventive, and so you're not just getting this point-by-point recitation of somebody's career. And some of them are just so well-acted that they can transcend the formulas. You know, some of these movies, you know, get brought up in the Oscar conversation. I would bring up a movie like What's Love Got to Do with It about Tina Turner, where you just have those electrifying performances at the center.
So before I let you go, I have to ask, is there a musician or a band that has not gotten their moment on the Hollywood screen, but you think is tailor-made for a movie?
Oh my God. Asma, are you asking me to suggest more biopics? I feel like I'm terrified. Like, if I suggest someone, I'm going to inadvertently will more biopics into existence. So I'm going to say there is no one left. Hollywood,
right.
If you are listening, we did Bob Marley. We did Aretha Franklin. We did Amy Winehouse. We are fresh out of musicians. So A Complete Unknown, it's a good movie, but there can be no more biopics about musicians. This is the last one.
All right. With that bit of advice, I'm going to leave you there. That's Stephen Thompson of NPR Music and Pop Culture Happy Hour talking about the new Bob Dylan biopic, A Complete Unknown. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Thank you, Asma.
This is NPR News.
Chappell Roan and Olivia Rodrigo are two of the biggest acts in pop music, and their success has helped establish their producer, Daniel Nigro, as someone who knows what it takes to craft a hit.
You start to like it so much, and then you actually like feel like it's special, but then you feel like, oh, are people going to understand this?
I'm Elsa Chang. My conversation with Dan Nigro on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. President Biden
is commuting the sentences of 37 of the 40 people who are on federal death row to life in prison without the possibility of parole. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports it's a major move against capital punishment.
Biden says his conscience and his experience as a former public defender and his time in elected office led him to commute the sentences of the 37 men. But there are three men who will remain on federal death row, who were involved in cases of terrorism and hate-fueled mass murder, like Dylan Roof, who killed several people at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina. Biden said he sympathizes with the victims of the crimes committed by those on death row, but he cited President-elect Donald Trump as a reason he took this action. Biden put a moratorium on federal executions in 2021, but Trump, who had a high execution rate in his first term, could undo that action. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
The federal government is now funded through mid-March. The short-term spending plan includes $100 billion in aid to communities recovering from hurricanes, wildfires, and other disasters. The measure also includes a year-long extension of aid to farmers. Today, Japanese automakers Nissan and Honda announced plans to consider a merger. This is NPR News from Washington. Party City is going out of business. The party supply retailer filed for bankruptcy protection almost 2 years ago, but says its plans to restructure weren't enough to overcome inflationary pressures on costs and consumer spending. Party City has been in business for almost 40 years. Wednesday marks 1 month since a ceasefire took effect in Lebanon. The country's health ministry says more than 4,000 people have been killed in the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah militants. The war has also caused damage to many of Lebanon's cultural heritage sites. Officials are assessing how bad it is. NPR's Lauren Freyer visited several sites.
I saw Byzantine fortifications of a walled old city destroyed by an Israeli airstrike, churches and mosques that had been hit. These are some of the iconic sites you see on postcards of Lebanon. But Israel accuses Hezbollah of hiding weapons and fighters in some of them. In mid-November, the United Nations added 34 sites in Lebanon to its list of protected cultural properties, hoping to prevent damage.
NPR's Lauren Freyer reporting. A NASA spacecraft has begun its record-setting approach to the sun. The plan is for the Parker Solar Probe to get closer to the surface than any other human-made object ever has. NASA says Parker will fly 3.8 million miles within 3.8 million miles of the sun's surface tomorrow morning. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
A lot has been said about the outpouring of social media posts in the wake of the killing of insurance company CEO Brian Thompson earlier this month, with many of the posts describing horror stories about what the writers said were their fights with insurance companies to get coverage for their medical treatment. But we've not heard much from doctors who deal with insurance companies on a daily basis. A major bone of contention is prior authorization, requiring doctors to get approval from health insurers before beginning treatment or to assure that the treatment will be covered. The American Medical Association conducts an annual survey of 1,000 practicing physicians to assess. How prior authorization affects physicians and the care they're able to give their patients. Dr. Bruce Scott is president of the AMA, and he's with us now to tell us more about what the survey results say. Good morning, Dr. Scott.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to speak with you about this important topic.
Well, thank you for talking about that. So obviously the AMA has been surveying physicians on this topic for some time. That's not because of this recent terrible incident. So how much of a physician's time would you estimate is spent on administrative tasks related to insurance?
Well, administrative tasks related to insurance, believe it or not, take up about 2 hours of physician's time for every 1 hour that we're able to take care of patients. And prior authorization specifically, the survey recently found, consumes about 12 hours of physician and staff time each week. And the result is, in a lot of cases, patients actually abandon the treatment or their condition worsens during the time that we're waiting for the insurance company to provide authorization for what the patient and their doctor has decided is the best for them.
You're a practicing physician. You've been practicing for quite some time. So have you seen this over the course of time that you've been practicing?
Every week. I had a patient with a tumor growing in her sinus in her cheek below her eye. And we talked about the fact that she needed a relatively large surgery to protect her eye and hopefully save her vision. And believe it or not, a few days later, she gets a letter and I get a letter from the insurance company telling me that the procedure has been denied because she'd not been on an antibiotic and a steroid nasal spray. Now, that might have made sense if her problem was a sinus infection, but she had a tumor. So I had to get on the phone and I talked to the medical director and we got the insurance approved. But imagine the stress on her.
I'm imagining that insurance companies justify this practice by saying that they're trying to keep costs contained. How do you respond to that?
Well, the actual results are that it causes increased costs because worsening health conditions, because of the delay that results, and patients sometimes then seek urgent care. And the results of our survey actually found that the wasted resources, 4 out of 5 physicians reported that it led to higher overall utilization of healthcare resources.
You can't help but notice that there's just a lot of anger out there toward the healthcare system, I mean, specifically toward insurers. But are you worried that some of this anger might spill over toward you?
Well, let me say that we know that patients are upset, and I hope that patients know that physicians are their advocate. Physicians are working hard to try to help them get the care that they need. And please don't blame your doctors. Work with your doctors. Many times the most effective thing is actually a phone call from the patient. The patient can contact their insurance company. It is the patient who is, in effect, the prescriber, the consumer, if you will, of the insurance product. If you're in a company, talk to your HR people who can have a connection with the insurance company and make the insurance company aware that you're upset and that you want to get the care that your doctor has authorized. Those are the constructive ways to approach this, not violence.
That's Dr. Bruce Scott. He is president of the American Medical Association, the AMA. Dr. Scott, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Folks, y'all know there's really only one Santa Claus.
Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas!
But some people like to dress up like Santa.
Your beard doesn't have one of those things that goes over your ears.
Well, that's because it's real. Just like I'm really Santa Claus.
That's, of course, from the classic movie Miracle on 34th Street. We talked to someone who can answer any and all questions you may have about your Kris Kringle outfit.
We want Santa to look majestic, elegant, and exquisite. My name is Doug Eberhardt, and I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina. I run ProSanta.com. My customers are anyone portraying Santa Claus or Mrs. Claus to the public. Most of the suits that I've seen look like someone ran over you with a steamroller and you're completely flat. I want to be known as kind of the Liberace of Santas. I want people to say, oh my gosh, look at that outfit. I've got some suits that have some beautiful Arctic fox collars, and they're just luscious. And then we pair that with faux rabbit around the cuffs, and then we'll put some beautiful braid or trim. Most of my suits are anywhere from about $2,000 to $3,000. That includes the hat, the pants, and the coat. I'm a full-time medical sales rep for a company out of Salt Lake City. I've been doing Santa since I was 14 years old. My mom made my first Santa suit out of a pajama pattern for a young man. It was horrible, cheesy, but my mom made it, and I still have the original suit in my other office. We not only do the Santa suits, I also offer two schools called ProSanta.school. We practice everything from singing to ho-ho-hos, like, you know, ho-ho-ho-ho-ho. I've heard a lot of different ho-ho-hos that don't sound very authentic. And we spend time on learning, how big should my boots be? How much play should I have in my suit? Do I need a toy bag? Do I need bells? What kind of bells? Do I have steel bells? Do I have solid brass bells? Very minute details that the average person would never have any clue goes on. There's nothing better for me to have Santas call me up and say, you know what? I just got this extra event because they saw a suit that was different than everybody else's. I want people to be the best they can be.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. You never know what you're going to hear on Morning Edition, especially a story about Santa suits, very in-depth. There's still lots more to get to this hour on the program. News is about 18 minutes away. Plus, we'll hear a story about carjacking trends across the United States. The number of carjackings is still above where it was at the start of the pandemic. This as other crime trends are starting to drop nationally. So what's going on there? We'll dive into the details still this hour on WPR.
PBS Wisconsin Education and the Wisconsin School Music Association have partnered with music educators to create ReSound, Songs of Wisconsin, a free collection of classroom media resources featuring contemporary Wisconsin musicians. The collection is designed to help general music educators and learners explore the connections between music, culture, identity, and emotion. Access lesson plans and more. Visit pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for WPR comes from McKinley Money LLC, offering fiduciary fee-based financial planning and investment management services to individuals and families with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. More at mckinleymoney.com.
Support comes from the law offices of Frank J. Parise, specializing in criminal defense, traffic, and DUIs. 262-656-9906. The law offices of Frank J. Parise since 1985. Located in Kenosha at 7001 30th Avenue.
On Wisconsin Public Radio. At 8:44, here's what's happening in news. The federal government will not be shutting down. This after a deal was reached on Saturday. That deal temporarily funds the government operations and disaster aid as well, but dropped President-elect Donald Trump's demands for a debt limit increase heading into the new year. The House approved that bill 366-34, and the Senate approved it 85-11. In other news, the 14-year-old who died in Monday's school shooting at Abundant Life Christian School in Madison was laid to rest on Saturday. Ruby Vergara was remembered for her love of music and animals, her creativity, and her kindness. And Governor Tony Evers has announced his pick for the new secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. That post has been vacant for a year. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Churchill Downs, presenting the 151st Kentucky Derby, dedicated to creating unforgettable memories for more than 150 years. The Kentucky Derby on Saturday, May 3rd. Learn more at KentuckyDerby.com. And from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. Before the internet or MTV or streaming services, there was Sam Goody. It's a record store you could find in a lot of malls across America. You could also buy turntables, speakers, and even sheet music there. Sam Goody stores were once ubiquitous, but soon there will only be a single location. The Sam Goody store in Ohio announced it will close in early 2025, leaving just one last one open in Oregon. Here to talk about the legacy of the retail chain is David Brown, a senior writer at Rolling Stone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So can you describe what Sam Goody was like at its peak? What were the sights, the sounds? What was it like to go into the store?
Yeah, it really was such an unusual place to go. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey, and there were many of them there, and most of them were in malls. And this was a period of time when trying to find music was a challenge. if you were a music lover and wanted to buy records, there'd be little mom-and-pop stores, but you could go to a mall, and there would be this entire store filled with records. And also, as you say, stereo equipment, sheet music, things like that. And it was, in one hand, kind of impersonal because it was in a mall and it was a chain, but it was also an incredibly powerful personal experience. They had rows and rows of records that you couldn't always find in other stores, you know?
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, you mentioned in your writing that this store was much more than just another mall business. I think a lot of folks imagine, you know, some retail is going out of business. Why is this different? Why is it different than just another mall business?
Well, I think, you know, when you go into a mall then, and maybe now, I mean, whichever ones survive, you know, there'd be like your anchor department stores, there'd be like your knick-knack stores and your gift stores and things like that. And here was just like an entire store dedicated to music. And you know, back then, especially, I think we kind of forget that music and, you know, pop and rock and roll, but before it was kind of mainstream, you know, and kind of assimilated into the culture before MTV and all that, there was still something kind of counterculture about the music and the culture of it. And so it was so, like, symbolic. It was almost, like, validating, you know, to go into a store and see, into a mall and see this business purely dedicated to, you know, the kind of music you'd read about in Rolling Stone, for example. It was quite a... it was like a vindication in a way of the music as well.
So there will soon only be one Sam Goody store left, one location left. What do you think led to the brand's demise?
Sam Goody had a troubled history from the very beginning. You know, it started in the late 40s. It went to a chain in the 50s. It went bankrupt for a period. Mm-hmm. The owner, Sam Goody, sold it to another bigger company in the late 70s. And it flourished for a while. And then it basically just... it changed hands so many times over the years. You know, it was sold to the American Can Company, you know, and then it was bought by Best Buy, and then it went to another company. And I think that was part of it. And also, you know, the decline in people buying physical music, you know, and the rise of digital music and online. You didn't have to go to a record store anymore.
Well, David Brown, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Brown is a senior writer at Rolling Stone. This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. 11 minutes left now on the hour. Thanks so much for spending part of your Monday with us, possibly getting ready for the holidays as well. Both Christmas and Hanukkah going to be taking place this upcoming week, actually starting on the same day. So we'll hear an interesting story about that. Plus, still that story about carjacking trends across the United States, all coming up before news at 9 o'clock on WPR.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios of WGTD will be closed from December 28th through January 1st for the holidays, and during that time there will be no morning show broadcast. But each and every day there will be a different morning show podcast episode for you to enjoy, with interviews drawn from the morning show archives. The podcast version of the morning show is available wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, but be sure to look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Green Bay Packers will host the New Orleans Saints tonight. That one starts at 7:15. Elsewhere in the division yesterday, the Detroit Lions beat the Chicago Bears, and the Minnesota Vikings got a win over the Seattle Seahawks, so the Packers are still sitting at third place in the division right now. In the NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks will take on the Chicago Bulls tonight. That one's set to start right around 7 o'clock. In college basketball, Wisconsin's men's team is 11-3 on the year. They got a win yesterday. Their next game will be against Iowa. That'll take place next Friday, January 3rd. A winter weather advisory is in effect for much of the state today as a system starts to work its way down to southeastern Wisconsin. Could see lots of rain and ice throughout the day, making travel conditions pretty difficult. Overnight, things should be cloudy and calm with low temperatures in the teens and 20s. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm Asma Khalid. The carjacking rate started to drop this year. This comes after a disturbing jump in prior years. NPR's law enforcement correspondent Martin Costi reports on data from a sampling of cities.
Carjacking is car theft with violence, or the threat of violence. It often involves a gun. Take this incident, caught on camera in Jackson, Mississippi last May. A young male shoots in the air as he strides up to take over a parked car as the occupants scramble to get their kids out and they yell at him to take the keys.
While these are scary events and traumatic events, they generally do not end in any injury or death.
That's Ernesto Lopez, researcher with the Council on Criminal Justice. He's been analyzing the recent data.
About 70% of carjacking incidents involve no injury, and about 1 in 1,000 carjacking incidents involve a homicide.
The FBI doesn't track carjacking as a distinct crime nationally, but some cities do. Lopez says numbers from 10 of those cities indicate that the average rate of carjacking nearly doubled between 2018 and 2023. This year, it appears to have finally peaked and started coming down again. But the rates are still well above what they were right before the pandemic. In San Francisco, Frank Noto, with the nonprofit Stop Crime SF, says crime is down in his city, but high-profile carjackings have had an outsized effect on people's sense of safety.
If you have a video or a celebrated incident, that can remain in people's minds for a long time, and I think people are still recovering from some of that.
Lopez says his analysis of carjacking has challenged some assumptions, for instance, that it's mostly done by teenagers. He says juveniles and adults commit the crime at about the same rate.
So it's not a uniquely juvenile phenomenon when you compare it to adults, but within the sphere of juvenile offending, it does appear to be pretty high.
What's especially intriguing to Lopez is the fact that the carjacking numbers post-pandemic don't mirror other crime rates, such as robbery. He says there's something unique about the recent wave of carjacking. It could be driven by factors such as police presence, the layout of neighborhoods, even the availability of guns. He doesn't know, but he says it's worth closer study. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This year, the first night of Hanukkah falls on Christmas. That means many interfaith homes will be celebrating both holidays. Some are even calling it Chrismukkah. For kids, this can mean the best week, two holidays, all the lights, and of course, all the presents. But for parents trying to navigate two very different traditions with meaning, it's a bit more challenging. NPR's Sarah Ventry has more on how people celebrate together.
It's a fake tree because we don't
real
like
tree,
getting...
that's too sappy.
In Morristown, New Jersey, Ben and Annabelle Lieberman show off their sparkly, well-decorated Christmas tree.
We have, like, my mom's, like, childhood dolls and stuff in the tree.
We have these two that we got from religious school, and they're like ornaments, actually. They look like ornaments.
Annabelle is pointing to two stars of David, made of blue-painted popsicle sticks. They're nestled in the tree alongside snowmen and lights. Hanging from the mantle, the kids point to what they call blue Hanukkah stockings next to red Christmas ones. There's an Advent calendar and dreidels. Ben and Annabelle's mom, Petra Weehee Lieberman, is Christian.
It's about honoring family and that the traditions are really important because of our connections to our family and to our heritage.
And their dad, Lance Lieberman, is Jewish.
I have to say, in terms of the journey of interfaith, which was certainly wasn't my envision of how my adult life and marriage was going to be, but it's been good.
When Petra and Lance got together, neither of them wanted to give up their religion. And for a while, it was fine. But when they had kids, they knew they had to make some decisions.
You know, when we agreed to get married, I wanted her to agree to raise the kids Jewish.
Rabbi Robin Frisch of the nonprofit 18 Doors works with people in interfaith relationships, specifically when one half of the couple is Jewish. She says this view is common.
For Jews, no matter where you grow up, chances are, even if it's a very Jewish area, you're likely to have been in the minority.
Which means for Jewish partners, bringing Christmas and Christianity into a home can be uncomfortable.
I think for people who are Jewish, it can feel very threatening, and it can feel like really giving in to the majority culture and losing what you are and that unique part of yourself.
Petra and Lance have chosen to blend the two faiths, not just for winter celebrations, but throughout the year. Petra sits on the board of her family's synagogue and also teaches Sunday school at her church. Her oldest child is preparing for his bar mitzvah and also goes to Christian summer camp. But many families celebrate the holidays separately, like Reverend Emily Brewer and Eric Eingold. They're a Christian and Jewish interfaith couple in Brooklyn. Emily told Eric on their first date that she was studying to be a Christian minister. Usually that kind of revelation made first dates kind of awkward, but not for Eric.
I thought it was really cool.
Once they decided to get married and raise a family, they went to premarital counseling so they could be purposeful about how they'd build a home and family. And they realized
that it was really important to us to have a child who was raised with both traditions and saw them as distinct and can choose one day, can reject them both, can figure out how in his own way to integrate them or hold them together, maybe not integrate, but hold them together.
They have a 4-year-old son who is learning about Judaism and Christianity. This year, Emily will be leading services on Christmas Eve at her church. The next morning, the family will wake up early and fly to Tennessee to be with Emily's relatives, with their Hanukkah menorah in tow.
We'll probably have our traditional Christmas lunch there, and then we were just talking about this today at sundown. We'll have packed our Hanukkah, Eric's Hanukkah, and some candles, and we'll do Hanukkah there.
Dreidel, we have one around here somewhere. We should pack and bring with us.
Both couples say that even though it can be challenging to raise interfaith children, there's beauty in it. Here's Petra Weehee Lieberman again.
I feel like what I have gained is so much more, and that we have both had to be more intentional.
For interfaith families, the quiet choices they make about how to raise their children, this week those choices are a lot more public. Is there a tree or a menorah in the window? Are they and their children praying the Mass or reciting Hebrew blessings? And will they say Merry Christmas or Chanukah Sameach? This year, it's probably both. Sarah Ventry, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Alex Crow, and however you're celebrating the holidays, thanks for joining us for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Appreciate you making some time for us today. It's 1 minute before 9 o'clock now with news on the way.
Support for WPR comes from Slipstream, presenting the Better Buildings, Better Business Conference, February 27th and 28th in the Wisconsin Dells. More information is at b4conference.org.
Support comes from Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, offering personalized tutoring from certified teachers that's designed to inspire, convenient scheduling, and affordable hourly rates. Explore the options, search Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, or call 262-694-6286. This is WGTD HD 91.1.